and have it as a fundraiser.
Oh.
I was okay. Thinking about that.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Phyllis has amazing recipes, and she shared some of them with me, and my family like it.
Wow, great.
Phyllis is an amazing cooker.
Do you measure, or do you just, you know, a little of this and a little of that?
Are you talking to me?
Anybody.
It depends.
Okay. Sometimes it depends. It depends.
Okay.
So some recipes I know so well, right. That definitely
you don't
measure at all.
No. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes, especially when it is new, yes, I measure and try to strictly follow the directions.
Right.
Blah blah blah. Yeah.
I think the recipe you have to measure is making challah.
Yes, I love it, Rabbi. See, most of the time you're doing the talking and we're in the dark. Now it's
funny. Right. Right.
I'm out into the light now.
I'm learning a lot today. I'm learning a lot.
Now it's our turn.
Yeah. Speaking of the fires of the kitchen, let's move over to the fires of Gehenna.
Oh, yeah.
How's that?
Rather go back into the
segue.
Good speech.
All right. Great. Wonderful. So let's just orient ourselves to what we were learning last time. We began a new subsection of Gehenna, the topic of Gehenna, where we're describing there's a punishment called kares, divine excision. And Ramban is explaining that the way kares works isn't necessarily that the soul ceases to exist, but actually it lives on, but it becomes disassociated from God. As we mentioned, the nature of things is that creations tend to want to return back to their origins. When an animal dies, remember we talked about the Lion King, the whole circle of life, the antelopes eat the grass, the lions eat the antelopes eat the grass, and the lions are the grass, so it's all the circle of life, right? So the animals return back to the earth, which is where they come from. And for man, our bodies return to the earth as well, but since our souls are a metaphysical creation that come from God himself, they yearn for nothing but to connect and return to God. And so for God to disassociate the connection between one's soul and God himself, that creates a certain level of distress for the soul. And that is the punishment of kares. So let me ask you a question before I tell you what the Ramban says. If I were to give someone the choice, they could either live a shorter life, they die very early, or they live a long or regular length of life, but it's full of difficulty and suffering, what would you argue would be more preferable? A shorter but more pleasant life, or a longer but far more difficult life?
That's a toughie.
When you say preferable, you mean in general, or, you know, because I think it's a very individual assessment.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I personally would rather live the longer life. Better mm-hmm. It's like better the enemy you know than the friend you don't. I'd rather, you know, right. Even if it's hardship, I know what this is.
Right. And so if I were to ask, you know, I guess we could answer from personal perspective if we want to, but also based on our knowledge of Judaism, both in terms of theology and Jewish law, what do we think, what do you think would be a Jewish approach to answering that question?
I think the Jewish approach would be to live a longer life because you can perform right. the vote as long as you're alive.
Right. So this is a huge, I don't have the specialty to talk about in great depth, but Rav Tendler, my Rebbe, who's, we have finalized and we just need to get it advertised, will be speaking to us on Sunday, November 22nd at 10 a.m., so he specializes in medical ethics. He always, every now and then, he goes off on a tangent and tells me about end of life and how you're supposed to extend life, even if it's not necessarily as comfortable. He had a whole essay on that, going back and forth, where he discusses the merits. So anyway, right, in Judaism generally, we try to extend life, even if it's not comfortable. But there definitely are instances in the question of euthanasia. What are correct grounds? What would be certain grounds for not extending? So, you know, that doesn't mean euthanasia directly. It can mean also, you know, not repairing a machine once it breaks. Or Moshe Feinstein talks about that. Why do I bring this up? Because it seems to almost be the Rabbana almost seems to take aside what he's about to tell us. So if you remember, what we just said last time was that God keeps the soul of the sinner alive. Someone who sins and receives kares, their soul remains living. It doesn't cease to exist. However, God keeps it going in order to make it suffer more. So if I were to ask you, what would be worse, for the soul to just die completely? Or for that soul to continue living, but to live in all eternity with suffering, what would you say is worse? Ceasing to exist or being punished for all eternity? That's not an easy question either. I started off with a non-easy question, and then I pick it's a harder question.
Harder, much harder.
Definitely a harder question. So I'll tell you what the Ramban says. The Ramban says, "Af b'midos haguf kein, noach la'adam shu misyaser b'yisurin kashim, sh'emuz b'yisurv l'shaito, yosef b'shiyicha yamin rabim." So he's not taking a halachic position, but he's saying in human nature, a person would rather die a little earlier than they would rather live for much longer, but to live in suffering for all of those days. I don't think suffering it means like, you know, that your elbow will hurt you every morning. I think it means like, you know, something more severe than that. That's what he says he believes human nature is like. Therefore, there won't be any end. So for someone who is going to suffer in the afterlife, if I were to ask you, better that he just cease to exist or he suffer forever, Ramban asserts that the greater punishment is to keep the soul alive, but to constantly keep it in torment and keep it, maintain it in Gehenna, or maintain it some level of punishment, which is disconnecting it from God. So that's how Ramban addressed it. He says the same way a human being would not want to live in severe suffering for many years, so too the soul would not desire to live in suffering for all eternity on a much grander scale. So therefore, one may think it's a greater punishment for the soul to dissipate and to disappear altogether, but Ramban asserts that kares actually is keeping the soul alive so that it could receive that punishment. So that's his assertion. Do we agree with that? Does that resonate? Does it seem like, I mean, I guess, you know, we're not going to start pulling off random sources from the Talmud and Medrash, but possibly, you know, maybe logically it doesn't resonate. But that's what Ramban said. So I thought it was very fascinating because in this discussion of the afterlife, he's almost implicitly taking a position on human suffering in this world as well. And he seems to make the argument there's almost an argument here for quality of life, that we value the quality of life over the quantity of life. And it's probably, you know, the pashtus, my basic understanding is that we would say the opposite in halacha, that we'd rather someone live longer, even if there are difficulties associated with it. So it's fascinating. The Ramban says that over here in a completely non-halachic discussion. But just to contextualize this piece here also, again, Shar HaGmul, it's the Shar HaGmul, the Gate of Gmul. So it's part of a larger book called Torah. If you thought this book was long enough already, right, I'll just show you the size of it. This is the actual book. You see the thickness of it. Shar HaGmul. Now, it's much thicker because there's a lot of commentary on here that I like to read beforehand. But Shar HaGmul is just the last gate, the last chapter of Torah Sa'adam, which is Ramban's book on mourning, the halachos of mourning, of death and mourning. And Ramban just dedicates the last section to Jewish theology, but really it's in the context of a broader halachic work. So I wonder, you know, maybe I just haven't looked deeply enough into the question of quality of life, but I wonder if this source would have any ramifications for that discussion, at least on a philosophical level, but it'd be interesting if it'd be brought to bear on a halachic level as well. So that was something that you could see I put a double underline over there because, well, you could tell which lines to me stick out the most. Anyway, the next paragraph we're going to
skip. Rabbi, forgive me. Could you just read in translation once more the underlined section?
The entire paragraph below over here?
With the double underline.
A double line. There'll be no end, no another synonym for ending, for kates, like nikates. It's no crescendo, no finalization. The Yisuraf to his suffering, Vitzaron to his anguish. So that he's describing the afterlife. He's comparing suffering in this life for a long time to suffering for all eternity in the world, in the afterlife. So there'll be no end at all to his suffering and to his anguish. That's what the Ramban writes.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. All right, so the next paragraph in Yerushalmi, even the commentary says, I don't know what this is doing here. It doesn't really make any sense. So to avoid confusing ourselves and throwing us off balance, we'll just skip it over. He basically just brings up this whole idea that we talked about at the beginning when we started this much before Rosh Hashanah, about how people who are majority mitzvos, but only minority of Averos, they go to Gan Eden right away. He brings it in for some reason, but it doesn't really, no one can really figure out how that fits. So we'll just skip this paragraph here because, and that's why it's in parentheses. Okay. Now we're in we're going to be talking about Kares in general, but we're going to take a side tangent here and talk about Seder Mashi'ir Lenefesh HaRasha Acher Misa. So after a wicked person dies, you know, what happens? What is the next course of action? So what is their, what's the checklist? So lest we think that there's some sort of holding cell, actually, someone who is wicked, they go to Gehenna right away. The second they die, I imagine they go up to the basin Shalmala, they get judged by God immediately, and then they're fast-tracked, and you can imagine they're up there, the scales are weighed, all of a sudden a trap door opens and they slide down a chute straight into Gehenna. He doesn't use that imagery, but I'm just using it because it helped, you know, I figured it paints a picture better. Instead, he actually says that immediately when the Rasha dies, his soul, a literal translation, is tied to the Wheel of Fire. It sounds like a name of a fantasy series I once read. That's Wheel of Time, though. And from there, it's connected. He becomes connected to the river of flame that issues forth from under God's throne of glory. For that is the fundamental beginning of this wheel. And all the flames of Gehenna, as we mentioned previously, issue forth from under God's throne of glory, which, as Ramban mentioned previously, is the source of creation. Fu yored l'gehenem, and then he goes down to Gehenem, v'imo misgalgeles v'yeres l'sham. So he falls down into Gehenem over there. V'zeha inyan dome l'gaguli hasibos achoseres av yasem b'chol nefraim. So this is similar in general to how different, let's just see how he puts in the parish over here. The Indian said, this is like what we said earlier, that all creations return back to their origin. So everything returns back to its original elements. So in a similar fashion, that is what's happening here. And Ramban, we've seen him do this a number of times. He says, by the way, the general world philosophers agree with me on this. He does this a lot, and I think I'm not an expert in the history of medieval Jewish philosophy, but my understanding is, so Ramban comes after the Rambam. Not by that long, but I think they're still within the same general era, the same period. So Rambam wrote the Mor Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed, as a guide for those who were perplexed. What were they perplexed by? They were perplexed because they read Aristotle. They read different philosophies from Muslim theologians. They read Greek philosophy. And Rambam was concerned that Jews were being led astray from what a true Jewish theology is. So when you look through the Talmud, you look through Medrash, there is Jewish theology. But except for like places like maybe Perek Chelek in the end of Sanhedrin, you don't have organized, systematic descriptions of Jewish theological beliefs. So in addition to Rambam codifying halacha for us in the Mishnah Torah, he took all the discussions in the Talmud and he said, you know, this is chapter one, halacha number one, chapter two, halacha, and he codified halacha. He also did something similar by writing the Guide for the Perplexed, in that he gave a systematic, what he believed was a systematic Jewish approach to theology. And he'll make reference to Aristotle, Plato, to different Muslim theologians throughout his work, because his goal is to demystify Jewish theology and make a compelling argument to his audience, which he believes has been swayed by foreign theology. And so many times they'll say, yeah, many times when you, this is just general, emotional intelligence, is when someone wants to convince you that they are right on a certain position. For instance, if you're arguing with someone on politics, what you'll do is, let's say you are a Democrat who is arguing against a Republican, a liberal against a conservative. So you may say something like, oh, of course, I agree with you. Second Amendment, we need to have our guns, I'm pro defending our lives. So you'll validate one of their positions, even if you don't genuinely fully agree with it. That way you could then say, but by the way, because I value life so much, I believe the mother's life is more important when it comes to abortion. So basically it's a kind of argumentation that you validate someone's argument to a limited extent. So that way you could disarm them and show them that you're not hostile. You show them that you're willing to agree with them. That way they're more willing to listen to the details that you're disagreeing with them on. So I think that's something that Ramban has been doing. I don't know if the politics example is the best, but I think that's something similar to what Ramban is doing, is that whenever he says, by the way, this is what the philosophers believe as well, he's trying to say, I know you guys have already read a lot of philosophy, and I want to show you that what I'm saying, a lot of it is already agreed upon by many of the philosophers, many of the theologians of the world, but I think we just need to tweak our understanding a little bit of how we understand the soul, how we understand Gehenna, just to get right in line with Judaism. But don't worry, it's not like I'm this radical extremist who's preaching something that is completely averse to everything else that we've been brought up to believe. So I could be wrong, but he does this very frequently. And, that's really the explanation I could think of when he does this. Okay? I mean, does that make sense? Has anyone else ever engaged in discussions with people they disagree with and you'll agree with a certain detail or their general belief? That way you could disagree with a minor detail that means a lot to you. No? Okay.
Yeah, I do that in my work all the time.
Yeah. It's just normal human interactions. It's a good way to operate. So that's what the Ramban is doing. Let's move on. So Zeh Oish Nosef Al Yisuri Gehenim Ke'in Karis. HaNefesh HaZuach Lozeres Yisod Eish Mitzmeso. So this soul that returns back to the fires, Bein B'tchila Bein B'sof, whether at the beginning or at the end, Nimsheches B'dayit L'Salso Dalek Bel Yonim. All this is what we mentioned before. This is where the Ramban spells out what I've been saying this whole time, which is that the soul just wants to strive higher. The soul wants to rise. It wants to rise to God. Kishar Kolad Varmisha told Dasan Lashim, just as everything desires to return back to its origins.
But Rabbi, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. Just one clarification. We're talking here about only evil people, right?
Really evil people.
Okay, so is this the people who are evil Gamur, or this is any of the gradations, or this is just all of them thrown together?
We're talking about Gamur right now.
Gamur.
Yeah, we left, you know, let me just, right, that was the very last thing we did at the end of last year, so, you know, thank you. I should have actually reviewed that. So you see, we start with this paragraph over here with the double arrow. The paragraph right before talked about Rishayim Gamurim Achamurim Shenidon L'Dorei Doros. They're the worst of the worst, the absolutely purely wicked, purely evil that go down to Gehenna for all eternity. Those are the people we're talking about. Everyone else, we said, depending, you know, some people, they go down to Gehenna, and then they get to go to Gan Eden after they serve their term. Some people, they're very wicked. They go down for 12 months, and then they don't get to go to Gan Eden. They live in some sort of purgatory where they don't get Hana and benefit, but they don't get punished either for all eternity. But then those who are purely, absolutely wicked, maybe they did one mitzvah in their lifetime. They got paid back for that, perhaps. But otherwise, these are the people we're talking about when we spell out this most extreme and radical punishment.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So this soul that we're describing of this wicked person, his soul, just by, not because he's a good person, but the soul, it's by its very nature, just desires to strive and to rise to God. However, this soul is so weighed down by the ovi, the thickness, and the gasus, the another synonym for that, the mass of his sins, that they interpose between his soul and God. His soul wants to rise to God, but his sins create an impenetrable barrier blocking his soul from returning to God. Therefore, that barrier of his sins that he's accumulated keeps him inside of Gehenna and prevents him from rising. And it's just it's not even just the fires of Gehenna, but it's the machshava, it's the thought of him not being able to return to his creator that causes him so much anguish. Vitzar gadol, she'ein lo cheger v'tachlis. It's such a great anguish that we cannot comprehend. Levad tzaryem, in addition to everything we talked about in previous shiurim, where he talked about how there's the fires of Gehenna, there's angels that flog them every single day, seven times a day, three times a night. There are these lions made out of fire and the pits that they fall into, etc., etc. In addition to that, I guess I wouldn't call it physical pain, metaphysical pain. There's a psychological pain that their soul cannot return, cannot rise to God. And this isn't just the wicked, by the way. We said, based on Ramosha Chaim Lusado's Mesilas Yesharim, in his work, he says that even people who performed mitzvos, who were in Gan Eden, they feel a certain level of distress. Why? Because when you see that someone got ahead of you and they performed that mitzvah scrupulously, so they get, you know, you get business class and they get first class seating, you think to yourself, oh, if only I was as scrupulous and kashrus as that person. If only I gave as much tzedakah as that person. So that kind of thinking happens on a more minor, smaller level in Gan Eden. But when it comes to Gehenna, this soul is in true anguish that it's not able to rise to God because his sins have prevented him from rising there. So that's everything. I kept referencing this idea earlier. This is where the Ramban spells that out. Audrey, were you going to? I thought Audrey had a question. Okay. V'zem inya kareso, and this is kares. Rotsa lomar shi nechrasis miyasoda. The idea is not that your soul is cut off from life, but it's cut off from its origins. Now we understand the translation. What is kares? Kares means to cut. The same way a get, a divorce document, is called a sefer krisus. I know we may have forgotten, but back in the day before the Yom Tovim arrived, we had something called a Chumashir on Sunday mornings. So we actually saw that pasuk recently, which referred to a get as a safer krisus. So this safer, so it's the same idea. Kari is to cut off, but it's not cutting someone off from living, it's cutting someone off from God. Kanaf hanikares min ha'ilan shuchaim imenu. Like a branch that is cut off from the tree. So that's the idea. Kares, we've seen the word in time before. Kares for a divorce document, for a safer krisus. It cuts off a man and a woman. But kares also refers to how a branch is cut off from its tree that it is nurtured from. So too, the human soul that receives kares is cut off from its origin that it receives nurturing from, which is like a branch to a tree, or like a human soul unto God. Kach amru chachamim, the Rishayim zomos v'holchos, that Rishayim, they get tied up and they continue to grow in that way. Shemar v'esnevesh oivecha yikaleta b'kaf hakela, that the soul of your enemies, they'll be flung around as if they were in a sling, like King David had when he killed Goliath, that sling. So the human soul is put into kaf hakela, which I'm not an expert in Kabbalah, but my understanding is that there is this punishment. Ramban, I think, might even get to this later on, called kaf hakela, which essentially someone gets slung from one side of the world, of the universe, to the other side of the universe, and angels just chase him down and beat him. So like a sling shoots a rock, this metaphysical sling, whatever it is, shoots the human soul. Rabbi? Yes, Phyllis.
I'm sorry. Is the word karet ever mentioned in the Torah?
Yeah, so that's what I was... right, so sefer krisus, for instance, is one, but also kares yikares. There's many averes.
Oh,
like,
yes. Yeah.
I'll give a few examples. Like chela, for instance, eating forbidden fats, that gives you kares. Sleeping with someone who is forbidden to you, being intimate with them, certain prohibited relationships also incur kares. In fact, actually, being boa anida, a woman and a man who have relations together, and a woman didn't go to mikvah, there's also kares.
Now, so weird.
What was that?
Where does karet fit in with the arba mitot beit din, skila, tzeifa, hereg, and chenek?
Okay, very good. So actually, it's very interesting because there's an entire sugya, an entire discussion in the Gemara and Makos, I believe in the third paragraph, the third and final chapter, that it's talking about kimle b'drabamine. Kimle b'drabamine, as some of us might be familiar, is the halacha that if I do one action and that action results in two sins, I incur the stronger punishment. So for instance, if I murder someone and I stab them to death, so I killed them, B, I damaged their property because I cut through their shirt and their tzitzis or whatever else they're wearing. So I only get the death penalty, but I don't have to pay back for what I destroyed in the process as well. I incurred the stronger punishment. There's a lot of halachos in there that we could discuss at another point. But in that sugya, there's a question that if I get kares but not mises based in, I don't get punished, I don't get killed by the court, is getting kares enough to also absolve me from paying back monetary damages? Since in theory, kares is some form of death or punishment. So that's how I would say it relates. We will talk about later on kares and misa bidei shemayim. Sometimes we use the term not kares, but we say death by heaven. Are those the same thing? Are they different things? Are they similar things? That's something we'll get to, God willing, in a few classes.
The based in mitot are physical, and the other one is maybe right. It's more, you know, emotional, psychological.
Could incur both. I guess the question would be also, I think it comes with Nagamar, is that if I get Mises based in, does that mean I'm also absolved from Kares because I technically already got punished? So that's a question as well. And I think if I remember correctly, this comes up toward the end of Makos. It says, well, how are we supposed to know if you got kares or not? You know, like we can't paskin, that's not halachic. It's either God will give you kares or he won't give you kares. Who are we to know what God is going to do? All we have to know what to do is how to judge people in this world and leave God to judging the next world. But what I thought was going to be asked by someone is, wait a minute, you mean to tell me that if just one time I eat a piece of chelev, I eat a piece of forbidden fat, I'm going to get kares and I'm going to go through all these punishments over here, described and suffer for all eternity? The punishment does not fit the crime. Did that bother anyone at all? What was that, Phyllis?
Now it does.
Okay, good. So I want to just whet your appetite for what we'll do probably two classes from now, if I had to estimate, where we're going to say that there are different types of kares. There's kares to the body, there's dying early, there's kares to the soul. We are talking about the most extreme form of kares right now. But what we'll see in the next section of the Ramban is how not all karises are as equal as others. Some are more equal than others. So we'll see that soon, God willing. But okay, we finished that paragraph. So now, you know, let's just see. This might be a good time to end. Okay, you know what? I'll save this one for next time. So next time, let me just summarize what we did today. What we learned today is that kares, the definition of kares is cutting off one's soul from God, and that the eternal punishment of kares is greater than if the soul itself were to be just dissipate. And kares itself makes sense why it's called being cut off, because the soul is being cut off from its connection to God. The way when a branch is separated from the tree, it loses its nutrition, it loses its life. So too, when a soul is cut off from God because of his sins, he cut himself off from God. That's also something important, by the way. I don't know if I emphasized this. We think sometimes of scharvosh, reward and punishment, as I did something wrong. God, you know, is like the cops. He caught me. Now he's the judge. He's going to punish me. But sometimes it's not really that we sinned and then God punishes us, but our punishment is sometimes a natural result of our sins. So, and I think that's really what the Ramban is emphasizing over here, that when he says, "Ovi avos gascha tov shudil beino beina yotzer monimosa," that the sheer mass of his sins have separated him, have disconnected him from God. It's not that God has cut this person off from him, it's that this person, through the sheer quantity and I guess also severity of his sins, he has cut himself off from God. That was him doing it to himself. So he has no one to blame. It's not even God doing it. God is where God always has been. But this person, through his sins, has cut himself off. That's an important point also, which Ramban, I don't think, emphasized, but I think that's implicit from what he's saying. So God willing, next time we'll talk about our Rayashish Onish Gehenim Achar Misbom and Neshamos. We'll talk about the proof how someone goes straight to Gehenim after they die. And also, I referred to this, I think, in my class. I guess last night was my class. I'm not sure if I referenced it during my Wednesday class or my Monday class. It all becomes a blur at some point. But we're going to talk about the reason for why we say Bihi Noam and possibly Vayitan Lecha on Saturday nights. I know a lot of us who I guess, you know, do attend or have attended shul are always like, you know, when there's a Yom Tov later that week, we all celebrate when there's no Bihi Noam. So the question is, why do we say Bihi Noam? Why do we make davening longer than it needs to be? And the answer is that we deliberately are doing it to make davening longer than it needs to be. And we'll find out what that has to do with Gehenna next time. So Yashar Koach, everyone. Toby,
you have Rabbi, can I just ask, just one thing I want to ask you, as we're going forward, I'm interested to explore a little bit how we, as living people, so let's say somebody commits an offense that is deserving of kares, and we know that they did that, and so we know that this person should be experiencing kares. How are we as a community supposed to treat that person?
Right. What you're saying is, if I know
like, in other words, like, so let's say somebody does one of these, you know, sins that are deserving of kares. So God's going to sort of take care of them in the future. But what? How are we supposed to be treating a person who's in kares while
how
they
would we know? The, right. Toby, how would we know that?
Well, I'm saying, let's say if somebody, there's certain set things in the Torah that if you do this, you're high of Misa. So, or kares. I mean, like the rabbi just gave us a few examples. So these are things we can see. We know they're provable.
Right.
If that's the case, is there a certain way that the community is supposed to treat such a person? Or, you know, do we excommunicate them?
Good question.
Great question.
I'd love to explore that at some point.
Well, okay, good. So I'm more than happy to explore that. And I think it probably fits a little better into the contemporary halachic issues class, because I think there is an element of theology in the sense that we're talking about punishment. But the bigger question that I gather from you, and you'll tell me if I understand it correctly, is now that we know that someone, well, okay, whatever happens to someone to get kares, whatever, okay? But the point is we know someone is committing a sin. How do we relate to him? You know, do we give them an aliyah in shul? Do we not give them an aliyah in shul? Do we give them certain recognition, certain honors in the community? Are we supposed to?
Whatever it is, yeah. I mean, yeah. Do you let your kid marry the person? Do you let your kid marry that person's kid? Do you, you know, I mean, there are a million ramifications.
So I'll give you al regal achas.
Food for future thought.
I'll give you the regal achas approach because, I mean, naturally when we're in rabbinical school and we're, you know, learning about, you know, how to be good community rabbis, they tell us that, you know what, you should expect in your community, unless you're maybe living in the five towns in Teaneck where you have like a homogeneous YU Orthodox synagogue, you should really be expecting that you're going to have people. Some people who are more observing mitzvahs, some people who are less observing mitzvahs. And the idea really, I'll tell you what the normative approach is. The normative approach is that we try to honor people and we try to give them recognition and keep them as full members of the community, even if they don't abide by all the mitzvahs of the Torah. The only exception
to what
really,
I'm talking about.
Oh, that's not what you're talking about.
I'm talking about a real bad one. Like I'm talking about, you know, something that there's no question.
Right. So here are the exceptions to the rule. One exception to the rule is if we know that someone sins deliberately, meaning if this person, okay, look, you know, this person, they eat dairy out, they don't check for the hecherim. Okay, really, you should be eating at a dairy place that has some sort of hashgacha that you know that the cheese there is Gavinas Yisrael. So, okay, but most people, when you go there, you're not saying, I am firmly against eating at any dairy place that has a Jewish certification on it. I dafka don't want to eat Gavinas Yisrael. People don't do that. But if someone did, and they made a public declaration of it, and in principle they said, I'm not keeping this halacha, that would be an exception to the rule. And then B, another exception to that rule, is not necessarily if they're doing it out of principle, but the nature of their sin. So if someone in the community is harming someone else, so for instance, if someone refuses to give a get, so then also that's a basis for not recognizing them as a member of the community. So I don't have the exhaustive list of the different heretics and all the people that we kick out. Hopefully it doesn't come up so frequently, but on one foot, that's the general approach that is taken.
I don't think you answered my question.
No?
But again, it's not for now. I don't want it al regal achat. I want to know what the community obligation is in terms of how to treat a person that is actually deserving of kares.
Well, he just said, he mentioned about the gets that, you know, what you do if somebody doesn't give a woman a get, we do certain things. So
that's not even in Torah, though, is it? That wouldn't be subject to Torah.
It's not. It's more of a communal development. But
yeah.
I struggle with the question because the question, as I understand it, is if someone does something that incurs an iser kares, the question is, should we treat them differently? And the challenge, you might be right. I mean, that might be a question we should be asking. The challenge with that is if the answer is yes, I mean, that essentially means any family that doesn't keep Taharas HaMishpacha, that the woman doesn't go to mikvah and she's intimate with her husband, they incur kares from that. So
whatever it is, whatever, okay, you know.
So I'm just saying, if we do...
I didn't say we were going to like the answers.
Right, okay, that's, you know what? I like that approach, because generally we're... Generally, sometimes in the modern Orthodox community, we're not allowed to give the real answers because of fear of, you know, the implications of it. But I just want to spell out that if there is ramifications like you were describing, if the answer is yes, they would be extremely far-reaching. And that, I think, is why most rabbis distinguish between someone deliberately sitting versus sitting not sitting in principle, because of that. That's really what I'm getting at. But if I didn't fully address the question, then, you know, next time we see each other, you'll do me a favor and try to explain it more so I can fully understand it. And God willing, I'll try to address it to the best of my ability.
You know, it seems to me as though there may be a kind of a plausible answer to that question, that who are we to decide how we meter out punishment for karet when that's something between the person who committed the sin and Hashem?
So,
well, there's plenty of instances in the Torah where we're told, like, you know, the
right.
The wayward son, you kill, you know, all these different, they're alive.
Yeah, but tshuva is always a possibility anyway. So we kind of, anyway, when we are talking with people, it is not the final point where they are here now. There are always the possibility of tshuva. So we don't know their next step in life. So I don't know it as a, I'm not sure that there's any kind of judgment in our hands.
That's what I just said. I think it's in God's hands.
Right, but I think also Toby's right to be asking what's our responsibility, because there is a mitzvah tochacha. There is a mitzvah to rebuke someone who is sinning.
Yeah, but that's after the fact. But that's after the fact. Karet.
Well, obviously, we could educate people not to violate prohibitions and incur karet.
Well, that's in the Torah. That's in the Torah. That's up to everybody to read the Torah and decide. But if they do it, it's already done.
Learning halakha is easier said than done. you know, someone can be learning halakha every day.
It's a good question for the discussion.
Okay, great. Toby, thank you so much for raising that question. And I'll try to give it more thought. Hopefully, we all give it more thought. Maybe when we reconvene next time, we could discuss this a little more and see if any of us have thought of any good answers to that question. All right. Have a great morning, everyone. A great day. Thank you for
learning. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you.